Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
WGN Welcome Radio. To another edition of Legal Face Off. I'm going to humbly say, Tina, it's the nation's most popular and informative legal podcast. Do we agree on that?
Yes, it would be completely truthful.
Excellent. I'm your host, Rich Lenkov, and co-host, additional host. What are we calling each other? We're co-hosts. We're
co-hosts. Co-hosts.
Tina Martini, welcome. Sam Panianiewicz is somewhere on the way, we hope, we believe. Ben.
He and Jason Whiteside are coming together.
Yes, yes. Ben is behind the glass. We've got an action-packed, legally informative show today. We have a variety of interesting guests. We've got Amanda Vinicky updating us on everything that's happened in the final days of the spring Illinois legislative session. That'll be interesting. We've got the founders of an organization devoted to eliminating notoriety publicity for mass shooters. But coming up first, we've got Matt Ford from New Republic discussing his proposal to
reconstitute,
we'll say, the Supreme Court. His article is titled A Better Way to Fix the Supreme Court. It can be found again in the June 4th New Republic. We welcome Matt to the show. Matt, thanks for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you for having me.
So former Attorney General Eric Holder said last week that the court should be expanded from its current 9 justices. That's an idea that many Democrat presidential candidates, including Pete Buttigieg and Kristen Gillibrand, have also endorsed. Don't these proposals further politicize the Supreme Court at a time when we have seen it become almost hyper-partisan?
That's right. And, you know, they do so in a way that would not actually fix the underlying problems. You know, court packing is a solution that has been widely seen as radical throughout America's history and for good reason. You know, one of the best known examples of it is during the FDR era, where he tried to, you know, add more justices to the Supreme Court to circumvent their rulings against the New Deal. What's striking about it in this circumstance and separates it from the other one is the lengths to which Democrats are going purely on sort of hypothetical partisan grounds. The perception that because of Trump making 2 appointments to the Supreme Court, the institution has lost sufficient legitimacy that it justifies imposing this burden on it, despite the threat it represents to judicial independence, to the institution itself as a neutral arbiter, regardless of how people might disagree with the decisions. It's an extraordinary step, and it's not clear if Democrats have thought it all the way through.
The Supreme Court has had 9 justices since 1869. That number was rooted in the justices literally hearing appellate court cases on horseback in their respective jurisdictions. There are now 11 federal circuits plus D.C. Does that mean we should now have 12 justices?
Well, that, you know, I think that's an option that's certainly worth considering and exploring. You know, what I explore is the idea that the justices could be expanded, the court could be expanded, by adding seats that don't correspond necessarily to political alignment, but by adding seats that correspond to geographic alignment. You know, having a justice who not necessarily represents the First Circuit, the Second Circuit, and so on, but having a justice drawn from there. This is an idea that is not necessarily, I mean, it's obviously being done because of some of the perceptions around the court, but it's an idea that is rooted in more of a neutral principle rather than a partisan one. And I think that would make it easier for Americans to digest and make it easier for the court to consider, not to consider, but to, you know, embrace, and for all the sides in American politics to come around to.
Matt, the balanced bench, as it's called, approach that you write about in the New Republic article requires a constitutional amendment. The last time that an amendment was successfully ratified was in 1992, and that took 200 years, only a mere 200 years. What makes you think that an amendment of this gravity could be ratified?
I think that there's a widening realization among Americans that not just the way the Supreme Supreme Court now operates, but the process by which justices are chosen doesn't really work. You know, if you hear one thing in Washington, there's bipartisan agreement that the Supreme Court confirmations process is sort of a joke. It's a sort of kabuki theater where senators try to divine each nominee's views on Roe v. Wade and other hot button issues. The justices turn, or the prospective justices refuse to offer those views, and we don't really learn anything about them. What's more, it adds an element, as we saw with the Kavanaugh hearings, of this hyper-partisan atmosphere, where every nomination, because of the stakes involved, is a sort of life-or-death political struggle. You know, switching to a different method of choosing justice for the Supreme Court would reduce a lot of that tension, and I think it would, in the long run, improve the court's image as an institution of stability and fairness.
One of the central components of any Supreme Court reform package seems to have to include term limits, which 6 in 10 Americans currently support. None other than current Justice Stephen Breyer has expressed support for term limits, saying, "I think it would be fine to have long terms, say 18 years or something like that, for a Supreme Court justice. It would make life easier. I wouldn't have to worry about when I'm going to have to retire or not." Why should these judges no longer have lifetime appointments?
Well, the solution I propose would have them serve 18 years on the Supreme Court and then return to the lower federal courts for the rest of the time they wish to remain a judge. So that way, what we would have is a system whereby they still have a version of life tenure, where they don't have to rely on, you know, worry about future employment. They don't have to worry about the prospect of making rulings that will satisfy a future employer. They don't have to worry about where their next paycheck will come from. Those insulating factors would still be incorporated, while at the same time, you know, term limits would provide a sense of turnover and refreshment to the court's ranks that we don't currently have. You know, we have a situation where now both sides of American politics choose justices who are in their, you know, late 40s, early 50s, who will stay on the court for decades. You know, this is not the way the court was necessarily designed to operate. And this would provide a pretty useful opportunity to fix it.
Matt, proposals like yours and the Supreme Court in general should be one of the central issues in the upcoming presidential election. We saw, of course, in the last election, how I don't think, in my opinion, enough attention was paid to it. I don't think people realize that Trump would now have, you know, two justices for the next 30 or so years. How much do you think proposals like yours and the court's makeup in general will be on voters' minds as they either re-elect Trump or elect his replacement?
I think they'll be on voters' minds quite a bit. And I should say that, you know, I think in 2016, it wasn't that the Supreme Court wasn't on voters' minds. I think it was very much on the minds of conservatives. You know, they faced the prospect that Antonin Scalia would be replaced by a justice nominated by Hillary Clinton, which for them is as unthinkable as, you know, Donald Trump choosing Ruth Bader Ginsburg's replacement would be for liberals. So Trump very carefully courted that sentiment. He published lists of judicial nominees. He published stances on the court that seemed to align with conservative principles. That made it a lot easier for the party to rally around him despite all the controversy. The real question for Democrats is whether they can manufacture and draw upon that same level of concern on their side. You know, part of that will depend on the steps the court takes in the months, 18 months or so between now and the next presidential election. But they also need to make the case to voters that the court is an important part of American governance, and it can't be overlooked anymore by presidential candidates on either side.
That's Matt Ford, who's a staff writer for The New Republic, covering law, politics, and the courts, at Ford M. And the article, A Better Way to Fix the Supreme Court, is a very, very interesting read, and it is published at newrepublic.com. Matt, thank you very much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Tina, next up on Legal Faceoff is a very important topic. We're very grateful for Tom and Karen Tees to join us. Tom and Karen, unfortunately, experienced what is every parent's nightmare back in 2012. Their son, Alex, who heroically was shielding his girlfriend from the Aurora, Colorado theater shooter when he unfortunately was shot as well. In the days following that tragic event, they founded No Notoriety, which is a movement dedicated to reducing rampage mass murders by lifting the name and face of the killers in the media. We are very grateful for Tom and Karen to join us today on Legal Faceoff.
Tom and Karen, thank you for joining us. As Rich mentioned, in the days after your son was tragically killed, you founded No Notoriety. We understand that it was in his honor. Could you please explain a little bit more about this organization's mission and what is known as the contagion or copycat effect? And how much of a problem is that when we are dealing with mass murderers such as the Aurora, Colorado theater shooter?
Oh, it's a huge issue. If you go through... In the past, the explanation of why the media turns these perpetrators into essentially anti-heroes was that we had to know what their background was so we could tie the dots together so we could prevent the next one. Well, the data is clear that the only dot that ties together is the majority of them want to be something because they're nothing. And the contagion effect is very real. It's been studied academically at higher ed, most recently at ASU, Arizona State University. And it clearly points out that in the 2 to 3 weeks after a rampage mass shooter, the notoriety that's given out, it becomes a call to action to the next ones. So that the data is without question in the favor of what we're asking people to do. And we're not asking for censorship. We're not asking to not respect the First Amendment. What we're asking for is what should be part of a journalist's credo, because it is basically the beginning of what they think is their guiding principles, which is report but do no harm and don't become part of the story. So when a lot of these organizations will say, well, we're asking for censorship, we've never once asked for censorship. What we've asked for is not to show the perpetrator in pictures where they want to be shown holding their guns. If you want to show them where they end up, either in the morgue or in chains for the rest of their lives. That's okay. But don't show them as anti-heroes. And you don't need their name 7 times. And literally, we've seen this in a 6-paragraph article. We counted one article. This is a few years back. They mentioned the shooter's or the perpetrator's name 41 times. That's ridiculous.
Karen, one of the more notable examples of what you're talking about, I think, is the Rolling Stone cover of the Boston bomber Tsarnaev that prompted a huge uproar several years ago, back in 2013, when if you didn't know that he was, one of the perpetrators of one of the worst you know, bombings in U.S. history, you would think that he was, you know, the lead singer of an up-and-coming band. He was pictured with a, you know, kind of a hip shirt. He had his hair tasseled. He had a goatee, looking into the camera. The title was The Bomber. Many people pointed to this as an example of media glorifying these, you know, despicable people. What are your thoughts on that? And also, what should be done? How should the media cover these stories? Your husband mentioned it, but what would be the ideal way of covering these kind of shootings?
Yeah, that Rolling Stone cover did create an uproar. What Rolling Stone essentially did was become a PR firm for a mass murderer. And that's exactly what we're trying to avoid. It makes you question the motivation in some of the larger media companies. If that was there for profit, or was it there to really inform the public? In that instance, I go with the former on that. But a lot of this has to do with just journalists being educated, and that's what Tom and I are trying to do. And as Tom said, we never ask for censorship. So when a journalist goes to write about a rampage mass shooting, in our protocol, we ask that they just name the perpetrator once. And we call them the perpetrator rather than the shooter to take away any type of power. And that's another part of our protocol. So just mention the name once, and you can report on everything else. You can report on the motivation, if it's there. You can report on the how and the why. And another thing to note is if the perpetrator is at large, we ask that they put that face and put that name out there as much as possible until that individual has been captured.
But the unfortunate, the unfortunate answer, right, to the question, I think, is it just speaks to what we consume as a society, right? I mean, there are movies starring teen idols playing Ted Bundy, you know, who was a serial killer. There was a very popular series that glorified a stalker. We've covered these stories extensively in our show. I mean, the people have a seemingly insatiable appetite for criminals. I mean, there are endless amounts of examples of movies being done about, you know, people who are reprehensible characters. So isn't it hard to stop this, you know, glorifying of murderers when seemingly the consumers, the American consumers, keep showing a demand for it?
Well, as far as entertainment, yeah, that's going to be rough. But as far as news and journalism and that is a matter of public safety. And there's been a cultural shift. I mean, look at less than 7 years ago when that coward went into a movie theater and killed my son along with 11 others and wounded 70. On every newspaper, there was a picture of a red-haired individual and going on and on and on. Look at just the end of last month, May 31st, with the Virginia Beach tragedy. Open up a paper there or look at the front page of a paper there. You will not see that individual that committed that heinous crime. You will see 12 photos of individuals that were murdered, that weren't. And there will be stories about the heroes. There's been a huge cultural shift, and hopefully the entertainment aspect will change as well.
Well, and there's actually an academic study that proved that 70% of news consumers would be just as happy to consume the news without gratuitous coverage of these cowards.
In addition to founding No Notoriety in your son's honor, you also founded the organization Alexander C. Teves Act Foundation. Can you tell us about that organization's mission and how it dovetails with No Notoriety?
Sure. Our son Alex, the month before he was murdered, graduated with his master's in psychology, and he had been interning at a school, a small school in Denver, and he truly enjoyed the work. And after his murder, we decided to honor him, not only with trying to save lives through no notoriety, but to help individuals that had special needs, whether it be emotional needs or academic needs. And it would be focused at that same school that Alex was an intern. So we, through fundraising, we supply scholarships to kids that would not have that opportunity otherwise.
We are very sorry for your loss. We encourage our listeners to check out nonotoriety.com and support the excellent work being done by Tom and Karen. We thank you very much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Coming up next, we've got a return guest on Legal Face-Off. We love having her. She always comes on to update us on all things politics, both locally and locally here in the city and also in Springfield. She is WTTW Chicago Tonight political reporter Amanda Vinicky. Amanda, welcome back to Legal Face-Off.
It is my pleasure.
So this has been termed the most productive legislative session in decades. Among other things, Illinois lawmakers passed a balanced budget, legalized marijuana and sports betting, opened the door for a Chicago casino, and a whole lot more. We'll dive into a good chunk of these in just a minute. But why don't you tell us about the mood in Springfield with all of this activity?
It certainly is a lot different than it has been the past couple of years. Obviously, when Bruce Rauner came in as governor, I think you saw a similar sort of energy in the beginning. It was new. It was fresh. There was a lot of hope. Democrats certainly had that. Even some Republicans, when J.B. Pritzker came into office, the difference being that by the end of Rauner's first year, much of that had faded, and instead you very much saw a partisan impasse. Republicans aren't happy, certainly, with everything that occurred during Governor Pritzker's first year. They fought, for example, against a statewide increase in the minimum wage. But by the end of it, you most definitely saw a bipartisan spirit of cooperation, unlike that we have seen. I want to point out to people, because when the budget passed, the governor when the governor that has signed the budget, he had this press conference, and we can get back to that. Somebody called it a watershed moment. To be clear, this is something that, by and large, Illinois has done every year. That's why the impasse was such an exception to the rule of getting a budget that at least is termed to be balanced and getting that done on time. In fact, this is the second year in a row that Illinois has seen such a thing. Republicans did join last year with Democrats to pass a spending plan for the state. That, however, was really, to me, the watershed moment, in the sense that you saw Republicans break from their party. This year, the leaders of the state GOP, at least in terms of the House and Senate, were in agreement with the package that was sent to Pritzker's desk, and you only saw some Republicans back away from that. They were the ones that sort of broke from the party to say no to the budget, whereas last year, the Republicans who supported the budget were the ones that were breaking party ranks.
So, Amanda, there's $45 billion for a public works program that has been branded Rebuild Illinois by the governor. Lots of spending on what's called vertical structures like clinics, nature center, schools, lots of money to pay for road, much needed, of course, road, bridge, and mass transit upgrades. To pay for all that, we're seeing an increase, of course, in taxes on things like cigarettes, e-cigarettes, rental, parking. The question is how much more
gas tax, of course.
Yeah, and to pay for things like pickleball courts, you know, upgrades to pickleball courts, as reported by the Tribune yesterday. The question to you is, how much more can citizens of the state absorb additional taxes to pay for these additional budget items?
Ooh, yeah. So a couple things there. In terms of pickleball courts, I saw that Trib headline. You know, somebody's pork project, in terms of this, you know, excess is really what that's termed, is could be to a legislator a necessary improvement to a neighborhood park that's meant to give kids something to do, as opposed to, you know, being out on the street with no plans, no school in the summer, and a way to prevent crime. So there's always, to me, a deeper story. Not to say I'm not going to make that judgment either way, but know that each of these projects, perhaps some, are merely to you know, use up money that kind of each legislator is allotted to keep things fair. Some of it might have been rushed and not all that well thought out. Maybe it isn't the most important project. Maybe that's a project that somebody has been wanting in their area, their park, their school, whatever, for quite some time, and it's a depressed area and doesn't have the money to pay for it otherwise. So just something to keep in mind there. In terms of how much taxpayers can absorb, whew, that is the question. And I don't have a good answer for that. I will, however, say that I don't think that this is it. That is all paying for infrastructure projects, again, to fill those potholes, buildings, what have you. But Illinois certainly still has budget issues. There's still a bill backlog. Property taxes are still what many homeowners feel exorbitant. And with changes, particularly in Cook County, to the structure of how assessments will be done, people, businesses in particular, but also homeowners, will see, perhaps be seeing taking even bigger of a hit with that. And then the city, of course, has its own problems. I'm speaking to you from outside of Chicago City Hall chambers, or Chicago City Council chambers, that is. And sure, Mayor Lori Lightfoot hasn't particularly closed herself off or the city off to certain other revenue increases. She's going to get that Chicago casino, which could help some of her problems. Money for that would be, you know, dedicated to public safety pensions, which are also indebted. But we could be seeing more tax fee increases along the way, certainly. And right now, people are going to complain about it, but it'll be up to them later to voice those complaints to their elected officials, vote them out of office if they're unhappy, or to say, hey, I recognize that and I trust that my money is going toward a civic need, and we're going to continue to support you.
So getting back, Amanda, to something you mentioned a minute ago about the legalized betting and casinos, that's been cited as what will be a significant source of the funding to back the public works program. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that part of what's been passed?
You know, so it is a Chicago casino, although there's no specific location. There's going to be a study once the governor signs that into law. He has not yet done that portion. He signed the budget already, but there are some other significant pieces of legislation that he has yet to do. And there was no real hurry along those lines. But once he does, you'll see things, I think, happen in rapid fashion. There's supposed to be a feasibility study that will help to determine if this is structured well right now, where the casino will go, it would be privately owned. But that isn't it. I mean, this is huge, huge, huge expansion of gambling. You're going to see those video gaming shops or restaurants, bars that have those can add terminals, and people who use them can place higher bets. So win more, but also lose more. Also, you're going to have more casinos, including in Waukegan, somewhere in the south suburbs, Danville, Rockford, and then way downstate. Current racetracks are going to be able to add poker tables as well as those, you know, video slots. So you're going to see gaming opportunities everywhere in the state of Illinois. One of the central questions is, with all of that, and you've already seen current casinos since those video gaming things came on the line take a bit of a hit, is Illinois actually going to bring in all of the money as anticipated? Or are people going to say, hey, this gambling thing isn't so fun and I can do it everywhere? Are they actually going to go to a Chicago casino? Will the city make money off of that? These are all questions that nobody really has answers to. But it's certainly that. And then there's also, of course, sports betting, which is something that I don't particularly do, but is very popular with younger generations, and there will be opportunities to do that online, so it'll literally be available legally at your fingertips.
You know, Amanda, maybe the next area of legalized betting in Illinois will be betting which Chicago alderman spends time in jail. We're covering here shortly the plea by alderman, former alderman Cochran, Willie Cochran's lawyer, as we'll cover here in Legal Grab Bag in a moment. He had an interesting argument last week before a judge asking for leniency. Ed Burke, of course, last week pled not guilty to additional federal corruption charges. That was last Tuesday. You stepped out of the city council meeting, as you mentioned. What do you think the vibe is in city council, given that Lori Lightfoot came in just a few weeks ago, you know, calling for a new day, end of corruption? She put aldermen on notice that politics as usual won't happen under her administration. What's the vibe coming out of city council and among the aldermen that you're covering?
She, of course, won that election in Chicago overwhelmingly. She's popular with residents in part because she does represent a change from that past. It's easy for her to point her finger at Burke because he is so very weak right now. Nonetheless, some of the old guard is sure not to take kindly to their being grouped in with him and to a change in practice as usual, not wanting to give up any of their power to a newbie. There are others, of course, in the city council who firmly get behind Lori Lightfoot and are going to help the mayor push through that agenda. Some might be more progressive than her. That's somewhere where we could see a splinter down the line. Right now, it is still certainly early, and so difficult, I think, to judge how that is all going to parcel out. But whenever I speak about the Lightfoot administration, I just say with the coalition that she built and how really popular she was, how overwhelmingly every section of the city, every demographic, every neighborhood, by and large, backed her, it is going to be difficult for her to make every one of those populations happy because often they butt heads. And so right now, hunky-dory, but she has a tough and difficult task ahead of her.
Well, she is a noted thumb war expert. That is Amanda Vinicky. She is everywhere. You can watch her on Chicago Tonight and listen to her right here on Legal Face-Off. She is always a welcome guest. We thank you very much for your time, Amanda.
I always have so much fun with you guys. Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Tina, back to our favorite segment, Legal Grab Bag on Legal Face-Off.
Always a pleasure, Rich.
Seven stories covering the wide world of legal stories. We cover everything.
We leave
no stone unturned, right? Remember the wide world of sports opening?
Yes, it was very dramatic.
The thrill of victory and the agony of defeat.
Yes.
We do the same here on Legal Face-Off. We're very privileged to have two guests in the studio. Dan Cotter is a return guest to Legal Face-Off. He is a partner at Latimer, LeVay, and Fayok. Did I get that right?
That's right.
And, of course, he is the author of a new book that we recently covered. Tell our guests about your book.
The book is The Chief Justices, a 230-year history of the United States through the center seat of the Supreme Court.
Excellent. Quite a read. Thank you for coming back. And then I was going to call him William, but he said, call me Wild Bill.
There you go.
Bill Donovan Jr., who's a partner at a firm called, is it McDermott, Will & Emery? Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you did.
We know that firm very well. That is Tina's firm as well. Bill, all the way in from the West Coast, flew in just for Legal Face-Off.
Great to be here.
We're very privileged to have you. Welcome. You guys ready?
Ready.
Ready to jump in right away with our first story. A local story here involving what we have dubbed an alder crook. That's a term that we made up here on Legal Face-Off.
I'm going to go get that trademarked.
Yeah, get it. It's...
You want to know how.
Alder crook, TM.
Yeah, got it. It's official. So there's a former alderman named Willie Cochran here in town who last week made a pretty interesting argument to a federal court judge about why he should not have the book thrown at him. He basically said that because of all of the other aldermen who have been found guilty over the years, it shows that locking him up and throwing the book at him would really not have any effect because, you know, if these other aldermen didn't learn from their sentences, then he wouldn't either. Pretty novel idea. Tina, what do we think of this interesting legal argument by Willie Cochran?
Boy, I'm sure that could be used in a whole host of scenarios. I think.
Hey, there are still murders, so why lock up a murderer?
It's not impressive.
No?
No. What do you guys think?
Fellas, what do you think of that argument?
I completely agree. I mean, the amount in question seemed pretty low, 14,000. His age could be a factor that could work for him. But to say that everybody else does it when we all know deterrent is a major reason why people are sent to jail, I think the argument boomerangs against him and could hurt him.
So, Dan, to give a little context to that, he pled guilty in March to wire fraud and admitted that he took $14,000 from a charity that was supposed to be used to improve the ward. He used it for personal gain. They actually dropped a number of charges against him in exchange for pleading guilty to this one. And his attorney said, and I quote, there are politicians who commit a crime, and then there are political corruption cases. He said, Mr. Cochran is indeed a politician who has admitted committing a crime, but despite what the government may assert, this is not in any way a typical political corruption case. He said that he was using the money because his wife fell ill, that she didn't have medical insurance, and due to the stress on his family, he succumbed to his gambling addiction as a way to get out of it. Does this hold any water to you?
I mean, as Bill said, you know, it's deterrent, and as a famous president recently said, he didn't care much for jail, I guess. So,
yeah, interesting legal theory. You got to give the guy some credit for trying it out. All right, next story here on our grab bag. We covered recently the states that have now made abortion either illegal or much more difficult. Georgia is one of those states, and Georgia also happens to be a state where the tax credit for film and TV is very favorable. So a lot of your favorite shows and movies are filmed in Georgia. Now Hollywood is pushing back and saying that if this abortion law is signed and is not overturned, we're going to take our business elsewhere. Tina?
That is about the story, yes. Yeah, no. So, you know, the news broke as all of this news about the various states, you know, and the debate over the anti-abortion bills broke. Georgia, for the reasons that Rich mentioned, is one state that's getting a lot of attention. Unless the ACLU is able to effectively challenge the heartbeat law, which for those of our listeners who are not familiar with it, instead of looking at the Roe v. Wade standard, which protects a woman's right to an abortion up until the fetus is viable, what the heartbeat law says is that that a fetus can no longer be aborted if it has a heartbeat, which can happen as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. What a lot of the studios are saying is that if this comes into law and the ACLU is not able to legally challenge it, many of them are going to reconsider filming in Georgia. And there's quite an array of studios that have already come out and talked about it, including including Netflix, Disney, Warner Media, and NBC Universal, among others. So, you know, they've been very politic about how they go about saying it, because they know that these challenges can go on for years. But they're also trying to be mindful of the people that they employ. And, you know, so it's going to be interesting to watch this. I know the ACLU has filed challenges across many different states, and so they're going to be very busy for the weeks and months to come. So.
Yeah, and I think Bill, Tina touched on, you know, the practical and then the political portion of it. I think Hollywood is trying to assert its influence, both in terms of, hey, we don't agree with this, so we're going to take our business elsewhere, as sort of a deterrent effect, as a sanction. But also practically, a lot of the employees that we have are members of this community.
Correct.
And as Bob Iger, who's the CEO of Disney, said, I think many people who work for us will not want to work there, and we will have to heed their wishes in that regard. Right now, we are watching it very carefully. So do you think it is appropriate, let's put aside the employees who don't want to work there, do you think it's appropriate for a corporation who's, you know, a for-profit corporation like Disney to make a political stand like this because they disagree with a law?
Yes. There's money in politics everywhere, right? Political contributions, companies and individuals hosting events. Hollywood, as the LA guy here, does not always do the right thing, but I think here they are doing the right thing. There's nothing wrong, in my view, with Hollywood or anybody else for that matter expressing their democratic right to spend their money and employ jobs in communities that they think represent their values and interests. I think if corporations become agnostic and they don't get involved, everybody loses. So go Hollywood on this issue. And if it were a right-wing cause and a different cause, I'd have the same view. They have the right to express their views, First Amendment, and I agree with it.
Dan, in some ways, you can argue that this move by Hollywood Studios will actually have the opposite effect. It will actually embolden proponents of these laws, because they will be perceived as, hey, this is Hollywood. This is left-wing Democrats coming in and trying to assert their influence over us. In many ways, that will actually embolden, I think, supporters of this. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that is a real risk they run, but at the same time, I do think that at the end of the day, they're all for profits, and so they have to have that in mind as well, as being political and taking these positions, because it does affect their customers and consumers, and at the end of the day, they're for profits. And, you know, right here at home, the ABA recently announced that the 2021 midyear is coming back to Chicago. They said for financial reasons, but part of it was they had a lot of pressure from some of their membership about the midyear being in Atlanta in 2021.
Interesting. All right, moving on to a story that's been in the news a lot lately is these Americans who have either gotten sick or died at some resorts, notably in the Dominican Republic. Of course, we always like to cover the legal aspect of those stories, and thankfully there's lots of lawyers who file lawsuits immediately after these kind of incidents. So one lawyer who has filed a lawsuit involves a woman who alleges that the owners of the hotel where the Colorado couple died, his client says that she also got sick at that same hotel. The hotel is named the Grand Bahia Principe Hotel La Romana, and she says that she stayed there and got sick after being exposed to pesticides. She said that must have been pesticides. She doesn't know for sure, but she said that on the sixth day of their 13-day vacation, she woke up with a pounding headache, and she noticed an overwhelming chemical smell that smelled like someone had painted the walls. They later discovered or believed that it was a result of this spraying of pesticides. They've now filed a lawsuit against this hotel. The bigger question here is, to what extent do you think these lawsuits will be successful? We've covered extensively in our show, and I handle lots of lawsuits involving hotels and restaurants. And the key question, you know, generally is causation, right? To what degree can a plaintiff prove that they got sick, like this woman got sick because of the exposure to paint or chemicals, or was it something else? Similarly, the other people who have died recently, you know, one of them had a variety of drugs in their system. So to what degree can you prove that the hotel was responsible versus these variety of other factors? Very difficult. Tina?
Well, I think, you know, you raise some really important points that need to be considered. But based on at least the articles that I've seen, there seems to be at least some level of a common thread across the cases that have been discussed in the press. And I think what it will take is getting a number of people. I don't know if it's a class action type of a situation or just people comparing notes here, but it sounds like this is a pretty significant problem at this hotel and that it's been going on for a while. Query what the court system in the Dominican Republic looks like. I think that their process is very different from what we're accustomed to here. And frankly, I'm not sure how easy it would be for plaintiffs to be able to really try a case successfully there with some of the differences that they have in their system.
You're suggesting the Dominican Republican legal system does not offer the same standards that perhaps we enjoy here in the U.S. It's interesting because I did some research, and according to one article, attorneys in the DR do not have malpractice insurance. So as a result, they charge up to 800% more than attorneys in the United States. Also,
wow.
This article alleges that thousands of lawyers are walking around with fake attorney identifications in the Dominican Republic. So I agree that probably not a great idea. But guys, what do you think? Are these lawsuits, are they going to be more successful if the plaintiffs can prove a pattern? You know, here in the United States, as in any case involving premises liability, it is compelling to show that the owner of a property, like a hotel, had notice of a condition and that there was a pattern and, you know, acted negligently or in ignorance of that pattern. That's going to be compelling evidence to any jury. Don't you think, Bill?
I agree. I mean, look, hotels have a legal obligation to keep their guests safe. If they're using pesticides, getting it in the air conditioning system, and it's getting people sick and killing them, the hotel's got a big problem. I think both of you identified a key issue, which is jurisdiction. If I'm the Americans, I want to sue here. You know, you get discovery. You're probably going to get a more sympathetic judge and jury. You know what the rules of the road are. The real issue would be whether there's some sort of jurisdictional agreement they signed when they checked into the hotel, and also whether the hotel has assets here, right? But assuming they can gather the evidence, sounds like a strong claim.
Yeah, and to your point, there is no discovery process or jury trials in the Dominican Republic. When a lawsuit is filed, it's up to a judge to decide when a hearing happens. Then the judge renders a decision. So, you know, not the way we do things here in the U.S. Dan, if you were the owner of the hotel, we often talk on this show about brand awareness and brand protection. Is this something that you would fight? They have come out already and said, we, you know, obviously strongly disagree with these charges. Or would you settle to just put the publicity behind you?
I think I'd do some more digging and find out how many claimants there might be and then try to settle this because it is bad publicity. I know in some of the articles they talk about the Dominican Republic and the hotel saying that this is the first instance and it's bad publicity with all the people that travel, but this is something serious, and if it can be proven that there's a cluster and common causes of action, they have a big PR problem on their hands.
All right, Brad Pitt is threatening legal action. Tina, tell us why.
So on the heels of the Pride Parade in Boston this past Saturday, news broke that these folks that are trying to organize what's being called a straight Pride Parade in Boston sometime this summer had decided to use Brad Pitt as their mascot, unfortunately, without his permission. So what they had done was they had put several photos on their website to promote their agenda, showing Brad Pitt with Angelina Jolie from their 2005 film Mr. and Mrs. Smith, as well as a picture with Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, where photoshopped in, you could see that she was trying to lasso him. So he found out about this and he demanded that they take down his image, and because he did not want to be associated with these folks. And so apparently as of late last week, the images of Pitt were removed from the website and they had replaced them with signs that said that they were censored and redacted. Apparently, Pitt is not the only well-known celebrity that is trying to, talk about the disadvantages or the bad spin that this event is apparently taking. Chris Evans is another celebrity that apparently decided to tweet out his message that maybe what these folks are doing demonstrates that they are homophobic. And so this actually was an interesting story in terms of how it broke late last week. So
intellectual property is your wheelhouse, of course. Why can't you just use a celebrity, Photoshop their image into whatever message you're trying to convey?
Well, because there's something called the right of publicity, and that's a state-by-state sort of a proposition, but you really can't have somebody who's famous without their permission using their image or their likeness, because it makes it look like they're somehow sponsoring or promoting your event or your cause. And you also can't do it with people who may not be famous because of the right to privacy. So,
Dan,
I thought it was interesting how aggressive these guys were, and that they were actually ignorant enough to do this without his permission.
Or were they? I mean, Dan, my question to you is, I have never heard of the Straight Pride Parade before, you know, this story. So was this a publicity stunt to try to get the word out about this organization?
Rich, I think it was. I think that this is something that's brand new. I think the Straight Pride Parade, I've never heard of it before either. And I think that this was a reaction to the Pride Parade that will take place this Saturday. And so I think it is just an opportunity for them to try to get the biggest publicity and the biggest focus on this issue that they can. And gladly it's failing.
They made it on Legal Faceoff, at least. There's no better, there's no bigger publicity stunt than making it on the airwaves of Legal Faceoff. All right, let's move on to another story involving sports athletic coaches who have done bad things, a common theme here on Legal Faceoff.
Yeah, we talk about it every week.
Yes.
So
what's going on in Arizona? Well, in New York, but with an Arizona coach.
So last week, news broke that former University of Arizona assistant coach Book Richardson was sentenced to 3 months in prison and 2 years of probation in the ongoing college basketball bribery scandal. He has a surrender date of July 18, and he has to forfeit the $20,000 which he had accepted in payments. There had been, during the trial, secretly recorded wiretaps featuring Richardson, which demonstrated that he had agreed to steer various players on his team to Christian Dawkins, who's an aspiring agent, as well as to a financial planner. While it doesn't appear that any players or recruits got paid directly, Richardson does appear to reference head coach Sean Miller, and it seems like Miller, based on these tapes at least, was involved in some of the deal making. But interestingly, Richardson, after the trial ended, issued a statement saying that he has no knowledge of Sean Miller paying players or attempting to do so, and that it was Richardson himself who was on trial and not Miller. So what's interesting is that this is one of a number of these cases going on. A former Oklahoma State and University of South Carolina assistant basketball coach Lamont Evans was sentenced on Friday to 3 months in prison, also because of he was accepting bribes to link top players with managers and financial advisors. Chuck Person, who's from Auburn, is going to be on trial later this year.
The Rifleman, so. Chuck Person. Bill, you went to UCLA.
I
can only assume that as a Pac-10 guy, you hate University of Arizona and are happy when things like this happen. Are we in agreement on that?
Well, yes. It's worth noting we have 11 national titles and they have one.
Yeah.
But Lute Olson was a great coach.
That's right.
I'll give him that.
Been a while since you guys won, though.
95. 90, it's been too long.
Yeah. In any case, I think the bigger story here, I mean, this is a huge story and it continues to get bigger, especially as Sean Miller is involved. But the bigger story here is it time to play or to pay players who are generating billions of dollars of revenue for the NCAA, for these schools, who are getting nothing? This is a debate that's gone back, you know, decades. But does this speak to the need to start compensating players who really aren't student athletes, who really aren't amateurs?
I don't think so. I think this conviction is an example of how money is pervasive in sports, and it's bad for everybody involved. But I think if you start paying players, it's only going to get worse. The richer schools will be able to secure even the more talented students. I think the students are getting an education. I hope they're all going to class, even at Arizona. But the bigger issue is amateurs should be amateurs. The sport should be clean. The game should be won out on the court and the field, as opposed to people putting money under the table, which I think corrupts the sport. And I think it creates a lot of uncertainty and doubt as to whether the system is fair. So don't have any evidence that Sean Miller himself did anything wrong. I hope not, for Arizona's sake. But I think the courts have to come down hard on these people who trade in money, buy players, and buy influence.
Dan, what are your thoughts?
I completely agree. And I played Division
III. Damn, I was hoping you would take the opposite.
Well, I could, but
it's not called legal agreement.
I played Division III football. It was a 40-hour week. And like Bill said, we were expected to be student-athletes. Students first, athletes second. Same schedule, same requirements, and most of us graduated. And so I really have a problem with public schools if you're going to start paying to play, because that's just taxpayers that are paying for somebody to go play sports at a
school. But, I mean, it's going on anyway. Isn't this an example of whether you agree or not, whether you like it or not, these guys are getting paid under the table, resulting in, you know, these trials. It's happening. The degree to which they're getting caught, maybe, you know, that might not be happening, but a lot of them are getting paid. So if they're getting paid, just like legalizing marijuana, shouldn't we confront the issue, deal with it, and then talk about, you know, what the best way is to compensate these people rather than keep it underground?
I mean, we could, but then we go back to Alder Crook, and then that's the whole philosophy of everything, right? Well, we committed a crime, but we got something good for it, and so everybody's doing it, and so what's the problem?
Got it. Well, Tina, we're going to say bye-bye-bye to that story and talk about a story involving a prenup agreement. This happens to be with Joey Fatone from NSYNC. NSYNC or NSYNC?
It's NSYNC. At least that's how I was pronounced.
Yeah. The former NSYNC star Joey Fatone has filed for divorce from his spouse, Kelly Baldwin, and they have agreed to abide by their prenup. The prenup, according to the actual document that we here on Legal Faceoff have acquired, right?
Yes.
For a crack investigative team.
Beep, beep, beep.
Joey Fatone will pay $4,500 every month in child maintenance, as well as $3,500 in spousal support. He says that his average monthly income is now $21,000.
That doesn't leave much money for
him. Not much. He said he's got $20,000 in the bank and $90,000 in cash.
What happened to all the royalties from Bye Bye Bye?
It's gone.
It's gone, gone.
Although NSYNC has had a pretty good career, right? I mean, they are now back touring with Backstreet Boys and some of the other boy bands. Bill, you're a California resident. Of course, prenups are prevalent in California. The leading state for divorce is probably in the United States. What are your thoughts on this story?
They are enforceable in California, and my view is, look, a deal's a deal. He should pay the money and get out on tour and earn more if he wants a better standard of living.
Would you go to that show, Bill?
Sure. If he needs the money, I'm happy to help.
Maybe we should get a group of McDermott folks.
We can do that.
To go watch them.
Dan, are you a fan of the boy bands in general? Who's your favorite boy band? We got to ask Dan Carter that very pressing legal question.
The Backstreet Boys.
Backstreet Boys.
Sure.
I went to a concert. Well, I shouldn't say I went to a concert. I took my 14-year-old daughter to a concert last night. Someone named Billie Eilish. Have you heard of this person?
Yes.
You have. Bill has. Do you have
I have a 18-year-old daughter. She just turned 18. Yes.
All right. So I was the dad who was sitting in the parking lot along with, like, you know, 15,000 other dads just waiting for their daughter to come out. She just turned 14 yesterday, but it got me depressed. I didn't know who this Billie Eilish character was. I thought I was
on
top
old.
Of most of the music. Should we ask the favorite NSYNC song? Tina, what's your favorite?
I love
NSYNC?
Bye Bye Bye.
Bye Bye Bye. Not just because I just said it.
No, no, I really love that song.
Got it. All right. Final story on Legal Faceoff involves X. Bulls legend Scottie Pippen. We love our Chicago Bulls here on Legal Faceoff. And Scottie Pippen has filed a lawsuit over some damages to a home he rented out. And what's notable is that he not only has sued the husband and wife who rented the house, but also their 5-year-old daughter is a named defendant. Pippen alleges that he suffered damages of over $100,000 as a result of this child defacing of the property with crayons and markers. He said that they neglected the home and caused it to become infested with insects, allowing pets to pee all over the home and stealing personal household items. In response, the defendant, who's actually a comedian, set up a GoFundMe page to help replace one of the items that Pippen alleged was stolen, which is a knife set. He said that...
Was it Ginsu knives?
It might have been Ginsu knives as seen on TV. but interesting legal story. Tina, have you ever been victimized by a child? Crayons on the walls, anything like that? Has that ever caused you to sue anyone?
You know, I just never knew that crayons could do such damage.
Pippen hates crayons.
Apparently.
That's the takeaway here.
I think this is anti-Crayola behavior.
Yeah. Dan, is this a lawsuit that you would entertain if you were the judge hearing it? Would you throw this right out? What's your response?
I'd throw it out. There's no proof that the parents weren't the ones using the crayons.
Ah, there it is. Bill? This is a L.A. story, if I've ever heard one.
There you go. So, look, I think there's two elements, right? The first is the PR element. And Scottie Pippen's team, I think, has not done him well here because, pun intended, this case stains his reputation. in terms of the legal merits, from what I read, there probably was some damage in this house and not just the crayons. It also looked like he had a $50,000 security deposit, so a lot of the damages are already covered. If I'm Scottie Pippen and his team, I sit down and I work this out as soon as I can because his reputation's not going to look good after this. And Scottie's got a bunch of kids, I think. We've all, those of us who have had kids, stuff happens, right? Maybe even assumption of the risk if he knew there were a kid in the house. But he needs to get this resolved, put it behind him, because the damage to his reputation is well in excess of the amount of damages here. And if by suing a five-year-old kid, I think he potentially has caused her a lifelong of maybe a college essay, which could help her get into school, but otherwise just sort of unnecessary pain, I think.
That's Dan Cotter and William Donovan, Bill Donovan from McDermott, Will, and Emery. Thank you both for joining us on Legal Face-Off. It was a fun show. We appreciate it. For Tina Martini, Sam Panianovich, who is...
Sam, where are you?
MIA. And of course, Ben Behind the Glass. My name is Rich Lenkoff. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN. See you in 2 weeks.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.